Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast, Explainer episode number 81. Today, we're joined by Abhi Kambli, who serves as a Deputy Attorney General in the Kansas Office of the Attorney General, as well as Aaron Gady, the Assistant Attorney General in the Kansas Office of the Attorney General. These experts will have a discussion on litigation against various federal agencies. So thank you both for joining us. I'll pass it off to Aaron.
Thank you so much. Abhi and I both serve in the Special Litigation and Constitutional Issues Division of the Office of the Attorney General. Abhi, can you tell us a little bit about what we do in our division?
Yes. Yeah, so this division is a brand new division. The Attorney General, one of the primary things that he promised was creating a Special Litigation Division that would protect the state of Kansas against federal overreach. And this division is designed to do that. It's not the only thing we do. We basically are tasked with doing an all of the above approach in litigating the most complex and high impact cases that come out of the state of Kansas. So sometimes it could be defensive cases where we are defending against state statutes that people sue on. But recently, our primary focus has been affirmative cases against federal agencies when they overreach in a way that harms Kansas.
And what are some of the lawsuits so far that you have worked on against the federal government?
So there's a bunch that we have done. So the two of the highest profile cases that come to mind, the Student Loans Part 2, which is the SAVE plan. And that case was Kansas v. Biden, later renamed to Alaska v. Department of Education, where we sued on the, everyone in this audience is probably familiar with the Biden v. Nebraska case, where the Supreme Court basically told the federal government that you can't have the executive, through executive fiat, forgive hundreds of billions of dollars in loans. And the president famously said, the Supreme Court tried to block him, but that they'll try another way. The same plan was that other way, where this time they were forgiving $475 billion in debt to FAPE. And what they did was basically reframe the terms of loan repayment into loan forgiveness. So we were the leading lawsuit on that one. And then another one is the Title IX regulations, which expand the definition of sex to include gender identity. And that one was the subject of seven different lawsuits from both states and private plaintiffs. We bought our case in the District of Kansas and paired with a couple of organizational plaintiffs alongside us, and were successful in getting an injunction on that one. And then some other cases that are out there. One we recently got an injunction on called Kansas v. United States. That was the one where DACA beneficiaries would have received subsidized Obamacare benefits when federal law prohibits any federal benefits from going to those who are here illegally. So we filed that in the District of North Dakota. And just yesterday, we found out that was enjoined. And then one more that I'll touch briefly on is Kansas v. Department of Labor. This was against a new rule from the Department of Labor, which would have given H-2A farm workers the right to unionize. And when congressional statute prohibits any agricultural worker from having that. So we sued and got an injunction there too. So that's just a flavor of some of the cases that we've done.
Thank you. And why is it important that the Attorney General of Kansas is leading on these cases? How does this fit into the broader constitutional framework of our country?
Yeah, so when you look at what the framers had intended, the federal government was supposed to be one of limited and enumerated powers, and the states were supposed to have a lot of power. So when you think about the big picture and, you know, why things like the 10th Amendment exist, the states were one of the primary safeguards against federal overreach. Now, we still have to demonstrate our own injury to be able to get into court, and there's going to be various considerations that, you know, involve policy in terms of determining, out of all the things that we could possibly sue on, which ones we choose. But the state attorney general's office, especially in recent years, have been playing a key role when you think about preventing federal overreach, so, and protecting the rule of law in general. So when you think of cases like West Virginia v. EPA, or Biden v. Nebraska, or this one was more of a defensive case, but the Dobbs decision, those were all things that originated out of the state attorney general world. And those are the ones that are primarily influential in getting the court to address the issue of when the federal government oversteps its boundaries to the detriment of states.
Now, you said that the states have to demonstrate an injury in order to sue. And an injury is an integral part in standing, which means that you need to be injured, it needs to be caused by the defendant, and the court must be able to provide you some relief. So how are injuries to the states the same or different than those involving private plaintiffs?
So there's a couple of things. States still have to demonstrate that they're injured just like any other litigant, and the Supreme Court has held as much. There used to be, there is a concept of special solicitude, although given current Supreme Court precedent, it's unclear at the moment where that's headed. But we do know that states, if they demonstrate injury just like any other litigant, they should be allowed into court. And sometimes the injury is obvious. So when a state is the directly regulated party, and this happens in cases where an agency is making a rule on a statute that they have the authority to issue under the spending clause. So in those instances, if the state is forced to either follow a rule that's unlawful or risk losing some federal funding, then that's obviously a clear injury. In other cases, it becomes a little less obvious. So one of the cases that people might have on the back of their mind when they think of something like that is Biden v. Nebraska. The way that the states had standing, and one of the more difficult parts of standing is when someone else is receiving a benefit or receiving money. In those instances, it's not as obvious to everyone what the injury to anyone is when the federal government is just giving out money. But there are avenues that injuries still happen. So for instance, in Biden v. Nebraska, the issue was mass debt forgiveness. And when you think about it from a big picture context, what is the harm when the government is giving away someone money? Like, who is actually injured? And you can't raise general taxpayer standing as a way to get into court to litigate a case. So the way that Missouri in that case was able to get standing is through an entity called MOHELA. MOHELA was a state-created instrumentality, and if loan forgiveness went through, some of the loans would be wiped off their books altogether, and that would create a financial loss for MOHELA, and that's a traditional pocketbook injury. And we used this, and that was a similar injury that happened in our student loans case on the SAFE plan. So when we look at the Kansas v. Biden or Alaska v. Department of Education case, Missouri was not part of our coalition, so we didn't have MOHELA as the source of injury. But we did have a multi-state coalition that included three states that had a similar instrumentality to MOHELA, except the difference was they handled a class of loans that would not have gotten the benefits under that current plan. And what they were seeing was a lot of people were consolidating their loans with the federal government to get these benefits. And once those loans are gone, they lose out on interest income. And given that those are state instrumentalities, which the Supreme Court has said is an arm of the state, they suffered a straightforward injury. And that's what got standing in the Alaska v. Department of Education case. And one other thing, the injury, the court is not looking for the extent of the injury. Supreme Court cases are pretty clear that a mere trifle is enough. So even a dollar or two or injury is enough to establish an injury for Article III purposes. And one of the things that we raised in the United States v. Kansas, which is the DACA Obamacare case, it's another instance where the federal government is giving away a benefit, but it does harm the states in multiple respects. So one of the issues and was that states that run their own Obamacare exchanges, they're going to have more administrative costs. So that's a straightforward, we are the regulated party type injury that was at play in that case. But the court also found another form of injury, which was in the cost that DACA recipients were giving to states. So basically, the idea was in every state that was part of the lawsuit, there are a number of DACA residents which have a certain cost to the state, such as in issuing driver's license or public education. And the data that we were able to present showed that at least some DACA residents were departing the states and or the country altogether. And if you're now coming back and the federal government is offering a pretty generous subsidy on healthcare, the reasonable reaction to that is that they stay. So even though you don't have to necessarily determine with precise numbers exactly who's staying, if we increase the probability that that harm occurs, then that's also sufficient for standing. So those are some of the injuries that are less obvious, but still constitute harm under Article 3 in order to provide standing.
In addition to financial loss, are there other injuries that a state can suffer? I believe they were referred to as quasi-sovereign injuries in Massachusetts v. EPA that give rise to state standing.
Yeah, so the Massachusetts v. EPA case, it was famous for coining a term called special solicitude, where if it's a quasi-sovereign interest of a state, that can cause harm. Sometimes that could involve changing state laws. So, for instance, I believe it was 2015 or so, when the DAPA guidance, which was the parents' version of DACA, so the parents and child of people who came over illegally as children, were getting special benefits. The way that Texas demonstrated standing in part was that they had the injury with driver's license and having a state law that issued them for anyone who the Department of Homeland Security deemed was here legally. And the counter from the Department of Justice at that time was the injury is entirely self-inflicted. And Fifth Circuit at least concluded that's not the case, because if you're putting pressure on a state to change their laws, that's a quasi-sovereign harm. So there was some of that raised in the SAFE plan in a standing, one of the injuries that we asserted that the district court ultimately disagreed with, but it is another form of injury too.
And once the state has established an injury from one of these regulations, what theories of, what claims are you bringing against the federal government?
So it depends on each case, but I'll talk about four claims in general that we're always, or most of the time, looking to bring. The top would be the major questions doctrine. So a lot of these cases, they involve vast expenditures of money from the federal government or issues that are subject to extremely heated political debate, like the debate about whether sex includes transgender identity and thing, or LGBTQ status or things like that, that are raging like a wildfire, but that an agency decides to answer for all Americans. Those are things that, the court says required clear congressional authorization as well, instead of just a plausible textual basis. But the other things that we argue are kind of your bread and butter issues, which is that the agency acted in excess of its statutory authority, or it acted contrary to statute. And that's where things like Loper-Bright come in. The way that I conceptually think about it is, if it's a major questions doctrine case, the Eighth Circuit in Missouri v. Biden described it as a heightened scrutiny of clear congressional authorization that's required. If it's not a major question, that doesn't necessarily mean you can have any colorable argument for authority and be able to do it. You still have to demonstrate the best reading of the statute is that you have the authority to do that, which is where Loper-Bright came in, and that obviously famously overrode Chevron, which I won't talk too much about since that's not good law anymore. So those are, you know, kind of two bread and butter arguments that we've been raising. Another is arbitrary and capricious type arguments, so basically procedural arguments under the APA. So it's not enough, for instance, to have the statutory authority to do something. An agency still has to act reasonably within that authority. So, for instance, if an agency were to depart sharply from past practice, but don't even acknowledge the past practice, don't acknowledge the reliance interest that people had on it, that's not reasonable decision making. So that's another area where we've been challenging. And then a fourth, which is much more applicable to states in particular, spending clause. So one of the Title IX, for instance, it's a spending clause statute, which means that federal government's not commandeering states in order to do it, but they can, as a condition of receiving federal funding under the statute, to make sure that a state actually complies with the statute. And one of the arguments that we made is that when you're addressing a spending clause statute, you're looking at what the statute meant at the time that it was passed and what the contractual agreement was. So for Title IX, back in the 1970s when Title IX passed, gender identity wasn't even within the conversation. So there's no real way that you can say that you met all the factors under the spending clause when that wasn't even a topic back then. So those are the four arguments that we've been making in a lot of these cases.
In what kinds of cases have you asked the court to apply the major questions doctrine, or has the court applied the major questions doctrine?
So in, I would say most of our affirmative cases, the major questions doctrine was raised. In two in particular, the court found that it applied. So the first was our student loans case, and that wasn't really a surprise since the court found in Biden v. Nebraska that a mass debt cancellation is a major question, which Congress would have required clear authorization for. So, and in this one, this plan was even more expensive than the last round. So the Biden v. Nebraska student loan forgiveness, the cost of that program was $430 billion. In this one, every court that's looked at it has said the actual cost is $475 billion for this new plan. So if economic significance is triggered by $430 billion, it almost, there's no real argument that it isn't when it's $475 billion at stake. In another case where it was more the political significance angle was our Title IX case, because that one, there is obviously a debate raging around the country as to what circumstances can you equate gender identity with sex, what different states have come up with different laws as to how to address issues involving transgender residents, especially when it conflicts with the rights of biological females. So that one, it's created a raging debate across the country. And there was another way that we raised the major questions doctrine. So in Justice Gorsuch's concurrence in West Virginia v. EPA, he talked about how when the federalism canon goes hand in hand with the major questions doctrine, so when a rule claims to usurp a function that's normally left to the states, which education has always been, then that also draws skepticism for the court before assuming that's what Congress intended. So those are kind of the different ways we've raised it in some of our cases.
And what kind of cases have you argued that the agency either exceeded its statutory authority or acted contrary to statute? And why is it important to make those arguments?
So in every case, we are raising that argument, because if they're acting within their statutory authority, there's really nothing to sue over unless there was an arbitrary and capricious type rulemaking that was so egregious that that it warrants a lawsuit in itself. But for the most part, every case that we've raised a contrary to statute and excess of statutory authority claim. And I typically separate the two, because it is different when something's contrary to statute versus when an agency is just exceeding its authority. So one recent case where we raised the contrary to statute was Kansas v. Department of Labor. That was the H-2A case, which was a Department of Labor rule that gave migrant farm workers collective bargaining rights. The issue was in the 1930s, back when Congress passed the Wagner Act, it excluded from its protection all agricultural employees. So H-2A workers, for background, are all agricultural employees. So it's a, but what the agency did was use its authority under an immigration statute in order to do this. And the court concluded, and they used the case, a quote from the case that says, while an agency may play sorcerer's apprentice, it may not become the sorcerer itself. And they concluded that that was contrary to statute, even if they might have the authority to issue regulations for H-2A workers. So that was one case where we were able to successfully demonstrate that just even if you have the authority to do something, you can't conflict with another statute that Congress intended. And that's what happened in that case. Another case that we're raising, excess of statutory authority, it's a case that's still in active litigation. It's called Kansas v. Becerra. And it's on this new CMS nursing home rule, which requires 24-hour, among other things, 24-hour staffing for a nursing home. So one argument that we raise is contrary to statute, because in the same statute, Congress says 8 hours is the floor and 24 hours is the limit, or 24 hours is required when it's sufficient to meet the needs of the nursing home residents. But putting aside the contrary to statute argument, there's a canon of interpretation that we use a lot in cases called the general versus the specific. So when you have what the agency was doing in that case, which is using a general statutory authority to care for the health and safety of patients, even though that authority may seem like it's broad, if there's another specific section of the statute that talks about the precise subject matter being regulated, so in this case, the amount of hours you need for nursing home staff, Congress spoke on that in a separate statute. So the general specific, the general versus specific canon says the general is not presumed to cover that more specific part of the statute. So that's another area where an agency can act outside of its authority. And the major questions doctrine also hints at that. Basically, if there's things that are going, the way that I would simplify it is, if an agency is doing very big things that you would wonder if maybe Congress should be doing that, they definitely need clear authorization to show that they have the authority to do this. So those are some cases where we raised both contrary to statute and excess of statutory authority.
And what about arbitrary and capricious? You mentioned earlier that it's egregious agency action or when the agency does something without acknowledging it's departing from past practice. Have you made that argument anywhere?
Yeah, so we make that argument in many cases. And one of the things we found is that the amount of legislating through agency, which is kind of what's happening under the current administration, has gotten to the point where it exceeded anything that's ever happened before. So for context, the current administration broke the record for most pages in the Federal Register. And I think it was, 96,088 or something like that. And the previous record was in the Obama administration, which was 95,000, but that took 8 years to do. In this case, it hasn't even gotten to four. So what we're seeing is a trend where agencies are doing a lot of things that Congress would normally do. And we're seeing some, to put it lightly, unreasoned decision-making. So one clear example that stands out, and we raise this as an arbitrary and capricious claim. So one of the things that's arbitrary and capricious is not taking into account an important aspect of the problem and the cost of a program is a very important part because especially in a case like student loan forgiveness, if the problem is student loan debt, if you don't even know how much money you're actually forgiving, then you're not considering an important aspect of the problem. And what they did here was they passed this proposed rule at the time that Biden v. Nebraska was still being litigated, and then they finalized it 10 days later. But what they, and at this, during this entire time, the original loan forgiveness that was at issue in Biden v. Nebraska was enjoined across the country. So what they did in their cost estimate for the SAVE plan is that they came up with a cost of $150 something billion. But the way that they arrived at that calculation was assuming that Biden v. Nebraska would be upheld. The problem with that was that it wasn't. And they were warned by commenters that says you need to do an alternate cost estimate because the cost of this thing is likely to be a lot higher if the baseline that you're using is off by $430 billion. And even though the case came out, or excuse me, even though Biden v. Nebraska was decided 10 days before they published the final rule for part two, they had a note in there that says they remain confident that they'll win this case. So the real cost of the program and the ones that courts have agreed with was $475 billion. That's arbitrary and capricious when you think of how unreasoned it is to not take into account the full cost of what you're doing. Ultimately, the court in our case didn't get to it because they found for us on other grounds, and it was the same in the Eighth Circuit. They found on the statutory major questions ground, at least in the injunction pending appeal, and we'll see what they do in their final decision. But typically what happens is if courts agree with us on the statutory grounds, they typically don't address the procedural or APA arguments.
In addition to joining other states, you mentioned earlier that you joined private parties, such as in Title IX. Are there other cases where you've done that? And what are the benefits of bringing private parties into state suits?
Sure. So every state approaches it differently. Some states don't join with private litigants. Ours, we do. It's a lot more economic in terms of litigation so that you're not having two different suits go on, or if you have pretty similar claims. But what we have found is that pairing with private plaintiffs does allow both sides to get their cases heard at one time. And each side has different harms that can be addressed by the court. So for instance, in Title IX, we had the harm of losing federal funding, which is one direct harm. And the private litigants, they also had other harms that brought other claims. So for instance, they had their free speech chilled based on the Title IX policy that would potentially punish someone who refuses to use someone's preferred pronouns, even if they have religious or other conviction or moral convictions that cut against that. So they had some due process and free speech claims that they were able to raise that we weren't. And the court considered all of them and ruled in our favor on both those grounds. Another instance was the Kansas v. Department of Labor case. We paired with the private plaintiff, which was Georgia Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association and Miles Berry Farm. And they were able to, states had harms because there were some regulatory and administrative costs associated with that, but they were also the directly regulated party, so they had a different type of harm that they were addressing. And together we brought all our claims, and the court agreed that the court, one, decided that someone had standing, so they didn't address the standing of everyone else, but they also found in favor on the merits. And sometimes taking the more efficient approach of pairing with private plaintiffs rather than the court dealing with multiple cases with the same subject matter, they can deal with one case that addresses the rule for multiple parties.
Now, once the Trump administration takes over in January, are these parties going to continue litigating the cases? How do you see these cases winding up over the next few years?
So it's a good question, and there's a lot of unknowns at this point as to exactly how that's going to turn out, whether that means we continue litigating the cases, whether there's a change of position. I don't know what's exactly going to happen. But the cases just don't go away because there's an administration that changes. It's still going to go through the litigation process in some way or another. What we can at least look to is what happened during the last change of administration. And it was interesting, to say the least. One of the controversial areas was whether a party can just end a lawsuit or settle altogether under the APA. That's an unanswered question the courts haven't decided on yet. So there was a case that we intervened in. This one was a little bit different since it didn't happen during the change of administration, but it was an instance where the current administration gave up defending its own rule in court. And that case was called East Bay Sanctuary v. Biden. Basically got all the way up to the Ninth Circuit. They litigated it for a little while. And at a certain point, for reasons that we don't know exactly why, they decided to stay the case and enter settlement negotiations. Now, this is an immigration rule that had significant impact for states. So a group of states led by us intervened in the Ninth Circuit and the District of DC where these two cases are going on. So it doesn't necessarily mean that these cases go away, because even if a party wants to settle, or the two parties that exist want to settle, there is always the possibility of someone intervening. So it's just unclear at this point what exactly will happen.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, this concludes this episode today. Thank you, Abhi and Aaron, for joining us. We appreciate your time. And for our listeners who wish to listen to more episodes like this, please check out our website, fedzoc.org. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye, everyone.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.